Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. Cocaine. Simply to utter the word today is to conjure up a welter of negative associations and images. The demonic substance, the scourge of lives, the destroyer of societies. You might be surprised to know that in the latter years of the 19th century, Americans ascribed completely different qualities to cocaine. Then it was both tonic and healer, and its cultivation and consumption were much encouraged. The progress of cocaine, from miracle to menace, is suggestive of its hidden history, which in turn is a drama played out in a tangled skein of national histories, all set upon a global stage for more than a century. My guest is Paul Gutenberg, professor of history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Paul, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks for having me here, George.
Paul, it's a delight, as it was a delight reading your book, a book you've edited entitled Cocaine, Global Histories. And as I say, I found it fascinating. And one of the reasons is you chart the course of cocaine in American and international history through differing perspectives, different authors, different countries, different viewpoints. I'm fascinated not just by the fact that you've done this, this is a focus of your scholarship, but you've made a personal commitment to it. And so I'd like to kind of ask you, if you don't mind, how you got interested in this, how you decided to focus on cocaine and to pursue it in this way.
Well, George, I was trained, and I've written several books before, as a specialist on Andean economic history. And in fact, my specialty was certain commodity trades, particularly guano, that is fertilizer trades of the 19th century. And when I looked at cocaine, I saw a very similar phenomena, that is an export that articulated the Andes, that is Peru, Bolivia, later Colombia, with the rest of the world, and it began to look at sources and to think about it in that way, as a commodity that, of course, has gone through many transformations during the late 19th century and through this century as well.
I want to ask you something about those transformations, Paul Gutenberg. I've used the phrase, and I think I probably got it from you, miracle to menace, which I think pretty much sums up the progression of the way we've thought about cocaine in this country over a century. But that in turn led me to another perception I'd like to try out on you, that the substance has always been the same. I mean, the fact that we think about it differently is what's changed. And when we characterize drugs as dangerous, and especially when we've previously characterized them as useful, as beneficial, does that suggest or doesn't it suggest that cultural attitudes really have a lot to do about how we look at drugs? I mean, it's as much a question of our choice of perception as of anything else, I think.
Oh, that's actually a very insightful question. Normally, when we think of drugs today, we distinguish between licit drugs and medical drugs, for example. And we don't think too much about whether the properties that we ascribe to drugs are there chemically, which is a very popular view, or whether in some form or another they're highly influenced by not only the ways that we think about drugs ourselves, but the ways that our government thinks about drugs, the way that history has told us about these drugs, the social circumstances, even the class circumstances under which certain drugs are used or abused. And overall, I would say, to make a grand simplification, among the people who study drugs for a living or in an academic or intellectual sense, there are two types of approaches. One is sometimes criticized, I guess I'm not being completely impartial here, as the pharmacocentric approach. And that is the idea that the properties of drugs are inherent in the substances themselves and don't have necessarily any important cultural or legal or historical overlay. Cocaine is cocaine because the alkaloid affects our bodies in this way. And in contrast to that approach is a broad variety of what we might call social scientific or cultural approaches, which in one way or another contest that view. They see drugs as differing not only in time, but in space across cultures, and drug use and the various ways in which drugs are used as important factors in even defining what you might call the dangers or the domesticity of certain drug substances. And I think this school would be more prone to admit that almost all cultures across time have had substances that they use in various mind-altering purposes, mm-hmm. and that each culture has its own ways of defining which drugs are dangerous ones, which ones are domesticated ones, or in other words, putting it in the framework of morality, which drugs are good drugs and which drugs we consider to be bad drugs.
The reason I find this, the cultural question, so fascinating, Paul, owes to your book, in which you chart the progress of cocaine, particularly in this country, over more than a century, and the attitude towards the use of cocaine changes so dramatically. I want to hear you talk about that, and I would love for you to set the stage by turning us back to yesteryear, to that period, let's say, between 1860 and 1900, or the latter third of the 19th century, when it was the drug of fashion. Mm-hmm. I mean, just describe for us what that was like. I think it'd be eye-opening.
Okay. Well, to begin with, cocaine itself was discovered or first distilled in 1860, and cocaine is a byproduct of the Andean coca leaf, which is a very complex herb, or it's the leaf of a bush from the Amazonian side of the Andes, which has been used for thousands of years by the natives of that region for certain sacramental or medicinal or everyday uses. There had never been that much fascination with coca in the Western world until about the middle of the 19th century, when for a variety of reasons, including the discovery of its alkaloid, more powerful alkaloid, cocaine, interest in this drug began to emerge across Europe and the United States. Now, coca products, which really need to be distinguished from cocaine, were various kind of extracts of the leaf, and they were put into wines, into tablets, into types of food additives, and they were embraced by a large sector of what we might call popular medicine in the 19th century, or what sometimes are called the eclectic doctors in the United States, those that were not did not belong to the allopathic or biological school of medicine that was to become dominant in the world in the 20th century. Now, coca became very popular in the United States in particular because, paradoxically, the slightly stimulating effects of coca and coca extracts were seen as a kind of antidote to a cultural condition that doctors thought was extremely common, almost the emblematic American condition of the late 19th century, and that's a disease that was called neurasthenia. Mm-hmm. We don't hear much about this disease now, but in the late 19th century, it was considered one of the most serious afflictions of the American population. Cocaine was distilled first in 1860 and had rather limited kind of experimental uses, mainly in Europe, until 1884, when it was discovered by a Viennese doctor to have these powerful local anesthetic characteristics. Then cocaine became a miracle drug. Mm. Cocaine was used for very delicate surgery, such as eye or mouth or throat surgery, surgery that was virtually impossible before that date because of the suffering of the patient. And in many ways, cocaine revolutionized surgery as we know it in the late 19th century. Soon after, doctors became very interested in a wide range of potential applications of cocaine. It was seen as a more pure, more scientific, more modern medicine. And in fact, cocaine was defined as a medicine almost entirely in the laboratory, right, which is why it became known as this modern miracle drug. Mm-hmm. Now, most of those uses, it was soon found out, were not that helpful, apart from anesthesias. Mm-hmm. And by the 1890s, doctors, both in the United States and Europe, had a more, let's say, mixed view of cocaine. They were beginning to recognize, well, they recognized very clearly that it had a number of possibly dangerous side effects, right, including a very early recreational use of cocaine by certain sectors of society.
Now, one obvious effect, Paul, or one result, I would think, of this period in which cocaine was viewed as tremendously effective medically, or at least effective medically, would have had to have been the encouragement of trade, or the, you know, the obtaining of cocaine. And that, in turn, I think, brings another actor into our story that's going to be a very interesting relationship to chart, does it not? And that is the U.S. and Peru, because as I understand it, in terms of the Western Hemisphere, at least, or the Peru was the major supplier, grower of cocaine. And that, or is it, let me pose it as a question, was it in that period that U.S.-Peruvian ties based on cocaine trade become quite strong? The U.S. actually encourages that trade.
Well, that's essentially correct, George, and you've hit upon the subject, which just happens to be what I'm finishing a book up here at the Wilson Center, which is about this changing long-term relationship between Peru and the United States in the definition of cocaine. Now, in the late 19th century, when this boom, this medical and cultural boom started around cocaine, there was a tremendous shortage of both coca leaf and cocaine on the world market. And German firms, and soon United States firms, rushed to try to fill that void. The only possible supplier of coca leaf were the traditional growers in the Amazonian Andean regions of Peru, and to a lesser extent Bolivia, and soon Bolivia drops out of the race. What happens is the United States does, in many small and not so small ways, try to encourage this trade between the Andes, which lies somewhat within our own commercial sphere, and the United States. And it worked.
Paul, I want to take a moment away from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Paul Gutenberg, professor of history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and editor of Cocaine, Global Histories, published by Routledge. Paul, I'd like to continue this very interesting story about Peru and the United States. In one way, perhaps, before turning into this century, in which things literally change quite dramatically, to put a final point on the characterization of the late 19th century, was the popular use of cocaine and coca products in American society at large. And for example, as I understand it, there was among the European carriage trade perhaps a very popular drink called Vin Mariana, is that right?
Which was Vin Mariani.
Vin Mariani, which was a product of, at least partially of cocaine, and much in use there. In our own country, the magic date of 1886 enters my mind right now as I think of Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not many drinkers or users of Coca-Cola, as it were, or its competitors, realize that Coca-Cola is directly derived from this popular American culture of the late 19th century of coca. There were allegedly seven secret ingredients, the seven secret merchandises of the Coca-Cola formula. But the most important of these were coca leaf, cola, an African nut, which has a very large caffeine content to it, and an awful lot of sugar. So it was kind of a stimulating tonic, almost a speedball effect for those who were in need of quick refreshment in the late 19th century. This formula worked brilliantly in the culture from which it came and was quite explicitly linked to the idea of coca as a restorative leaf.
There is a point, though, isn't there, Paul, where coca is taken out of the Coca-Cola formula?
Well, coca per se is not taken out of the Coca-Cola formula. What happened is around 1903, cocaine is taken out of the Coca-Cola formula. A Coca-Cola company is seeing increasing opposition. Many social critics of the time began to charge that coke was the same thing as dope, and saw the rise, especially in the South, of Southern and, to in their eyes, largely black cocaine users who were using Coca-Cola. These issues became very racialized, and one is sometimes shocked by the amount of racism that surrounds drug issues at this time.
I think one way of looking at this period of time when the formula Coca-Cola is changing is that clearly the attitudes about cocaine have been undergoing change. You earlier alluded to medical reassessments taking place in the 1890s, and I think you've just been adding for us to our story some stereotyping in terms of the users and sort of the social reputation of the substance. That in turn results in a tremendous shift of attitude in the United States, does it not, about cocaine, which must have repercussions clearly on Peru and on the trade, starting from about 1900 on to about 1920.
Well, that's correct, and there are echoes of these types of transformations across the world. Now, to put this in a bit of context, this was the same period when other drugs, narcotics, opiates, were also coming into question as dangerous substances. And as well in the United States, to make the situation even more dramatic, was the period of the rising movement for the prohibition of alcohol.
Right.
Cocaine and the opiates were seen as part of this movement of social reform.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's an extremely complex movement that results finally in 1914 with the first national anti-narcotics legislation in the United States, and that's the Harrison Narcotics Act. There are so many actors involved, and it's so difficult to distill what they were thinking about drugs into one particular reason for outlawing or trying to banish these substances. And one also has to add that there was a kind of larger struggle going on here about how American society would regulate the free enterprise of pharmaceutical concerns and pharmacists. Could they make and produce potentially dangerous drugs like cocaine, or should it be in the control only of medical doctors, certain types mm-hmm. of certified professional medical doctors, or in the control of the U.S. government itself? Well, in the long term, it comes down, even the doctors were excluded from this type of control, only the Treasury Department and later Federal Bureau of Narcotics was to control drugs such as
this. When do we get, Paul, in this story, or as an outcome of the progression you've been describing for us, the United States as the champion of global prohibition of cocaine?
Well, that's an interesting question because for reasons that I'm still not convinced historians have a handle on, the United States from a very early period is almost the sole crusader in the world against cocaine, and for that matter, against many of the other major drug users. Starting around 1908, 1909, a number of international conventions are called to control some of the narcotic substances used worldwide. There's one in Shanghai, mm-hmm. later one in The Hague, and then a series of conventions in the 1920s under the League of Nations in Geneva. Mostly these conventions were concerned with the use of the opiates. Even opium smoking in China was considered to be the largest drug scourge of the early 20th century world. And this was a revolutionary movement, by the way, in international jurisprudence, the idea that this type of morality or this type of trade could and should be controlled on the international right. scale. Nothing like this had ever been tried before. There were other interests in the cocaine trade at that time, but it was the United States that pushed for this idea of banning, controlling, and ultimately abolishing cocaine from the world scene.
And the impression I got was that the world at large, or at least many other countries, did not go along with this. It was met with either indifference or some degrees of opposition. And for our purposes right now in our conversation, what was the reaction in Peru as the United States moves to this posture?
Well, I think in countries like Peru that had a long historical relationship with coca as a native good, and then this new commercial or national relationship with an export called cocaine, I think at first many people were quite perplexed by this turnabout. First, they were told that these were good things to produce and export on a world scale, and then they were told, no, that these were bad things. Mm-hmm. And it took quite a while for this message to be finally completely absorbed and even accepted in the Andean scene. In fact, it took to about 1950 mm-hmm. for the Peruvians to come around themselves and outlaw the legal production of cocaine and move themselves to try to regulate coca leaf production.
There's a paradox in the book, Paul, I thought. A paradox in the story, actually, because as the regime of prohibition gains force and becomes kind of a dominant factor, we enter sort of phase three of the story. And the paradox to my mind was this: the success, in quotes, or at least the the extreme pressure of the prohibition movement worldwide creates, obviously, the market for illicit cocaine. Does it not? Or at least it intensifies it, it seems to me, and leads to the involvement of other actors in the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a complicated question, but I'm beginning to lean towards grasping it in that way. The era between about 1910 and 1950 was a very interesting era in the history of cocaine because there were a great diversity of ways in which the drug was produced and controlled and seen throughout the world. Mm-hmm. Other drugs took off in this period instead, such as heroin, but the United States was relatively successful in reducing cocaine from a drug that was in widespread use around 1900 to one that, say, in 1940, almost no one had ever heard of.
Right.
Okay. The paradox in this is that this was the period in which that there were, in which across the world, in Dutch colonies, in the Andes, in Southeast Asia by the Japanese, there were large-scale legal producers of coca and cocaine. And in other parts of the world, the attitudes towards coca and cocaine were not as draconian as they were in the United States. To me, this suggests a paradox that in the period in which we had not yet closed off all avenues for other forms of looking at or controlling this drug, we were most successful in controlling it within our own borders, within our own society. Hmm. That was to change after 1950.
Right. And what do we see after 1950?
Well, you see a number of developments, and many of them, I have to say, have not really been traced that closely before. Now, the first movement, which is very important to grasp, is that after World War II, the United States, which of course emerged far more powerful in almost every realm of activity internationally, also emerged very powerful in the world of international drug control. And the United States, working through the United Nations, by 1950 had achieved something that it had never dreamed of achieving before, which was to get all countries involved in the production of coca and cocaine to agree to criminalize and restrict its production. Most importantly in this case was Peru, which finally in 1949 criminalized cocaine and began to build its own anti-drug apparatus.
So what's the outcome of that criminalization? If we confine the story to Peru for a moment, mm-hmm. does that simply shift it somewhere else, even though other countries have signed the convention?
Well, there are two outcomes. One is that in international juridical terms, the United States and anti-drug officials look very successful. Mm-hmm. This leads right into the 1961 UN Single Convention, which not only solidifies all existing anti-narcotics legislation, but in the case of cocaine, sets the goal of the eradication of the coca bush itself in a period of two decades or so. Quite utopian goal as we now look back at it. The other side of the coin, though, and this is something that I've been discovering myself as I've delved into a good deal of declassified archives at the National Archives, archives of the predecessor organizations of the Drug Enforcement Administration, is that since 1950 until the mid-1970s, the United States was really fighting a kind of secret war against a new enemy, and that new enemy was illicit criminal cocaine that was coming out of the Andes.
You have, in this conversation, told us about a period when the United States essentially became a crusader in the course of pursuit of world prohibition of cocaine, a very, very active role. And in our time, we hear a great deal about the, quote, war on drugs, with cocaine and other substances being the enemy. What's your opinion of that war?
Well, I have to say that I don't have a very high opinion of any type of war to begin with. But Well, let me preface this, George, by saying that I am definitely an historian by training and profession, which means that I can tell us a good deal about how we got into the situation, or rather the mess we're in with cocaine today, but I can't quite exactly tell you what we should do to get out of that mess. It's kind of a luxury that historians enjoy. But given that, let me try to back up and at least put a little perspective on the problem. One thing I think that we should bear in mind is that the so-called war on drugs is not a new phenomena. That is, we usually think of it as something that emerged with President Nixon or then became escalated, especially with President Bush in the late 1980s. But in fact, the war on drugs in the United States began at the turn of the century. So if we're going to try to measure or judge the effectiveness of these tactics, the ones that have tried to criminalize substances rather than look at other solutions, such as seeing it as a public health problem or even more creative solutions beyond that, we have to measure it as a century of performance. And seen as a century of performance, the U.S. war on drugs has dismally failed. There are far more drugs and far more dangerous drugs being used in American society today after spending billions of dollars and after incarcerating literally millions, mainly young men, around this problem. Now, I'm speaking mainly as a citizen, not as a historian and not as a social scientist, but I would add that outside of the rather narrow confines of the U.S. government or the agencies that are specialized in this crusade, there's a great deal of new thinking going on about drugs and drug problems these days. And hopefully in the 21st century, we're going to end up having a different and more, let's say, humane approach to the problem than we've had up to this time.
Paul, I find that a very hopeful conclusion to a very helpful conversation. Thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue today.
No, thank you for the dialogue.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Paul Gutenberg, professor of history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistant is Andrea Bertone. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.